Okay. Then each of us, there's a kind of a madness, and it takes you by surprise. Competition is part of this. This part of your nature is not fueled by good stuff. This part is fueled by ruthlessness. This part is the part that would go into somebody's cabinet, a best friend's purse, and rationalize whatever they needed to do to get ahead, to take money. This is the part where someone says, I can't believe your son stole from you to buy drugs. This is where they rationalize, because my body needs it, it doesn't mind that my character is compromised. My animal nature can be excused because of this addiction. This is the position our culture takes. That because the body craves it, it's okay for the character to be flawed. I leave it to each of you to decide how you feel about that. I personally don't accept that position. I don't care about what your body craves. You cannot maintain a theology of free choice, free will, and then decide when to apply it. And when not to. You can't decide that because it happens to be that you're an addict, I will release you from free will. How can you release anybody from the doctrine of free will? How can you do that? You simply cannot. Who are you to release a human being from free will? Because they happen to enjoy choosing heroin, or choosing to steal money, or letting their animal nature get the best of them. They happen to be addicted to violence. This is the addiction right here, where their body's addicted to pornography, where their physical rushes turn them on, and it's as simple as that. They don't want to control that. Child porn, whatever it is, this is that place. This is where you're addicted to yourself, to yourself, to whatever it is you need, to whatever it is you think. Now, this is a tough addiction for you to plow through. This is the one where if we were together, we'd be together for a week just on this one. Your addiction to your own self-indulgences, to how you see yourself, to how you need to see yourself, to how you've built the mythologies you've built around yourself, to what you tell yourself, to what's true. What if you don't tell yourself the truth? What if you are an artist, and you tell yourself, no, you're not? What if you lie to yourself about your own talent? What if you do that? What if you undercut your own talent? What if you undercut your own possibility? This is where you're going to do it, is right here. Your animal nature. You're going to do it because of a sense of terror. This is where you're going to tell yourself what you can and cannot do. Can't do that. I can't do that. I won't do that. This is where you're going to meet that part. This is where your entitlements are. Look out. What you absolutely believe you're entitled to. Somebody on my radio show said the other day, I'm entitled to happiness. She said, I'm entitled to happiness. And I said, you are? And what would make you happy? I said, who's going to deliver that happiness to you? Where'd you get that idea? And what's happiness? And by the time I finished with her, of course, she was totally confounded. I said, do you know that entitlement means that somebody was born just for the sole purpose of delivering it? She says, I deserve happiness. And I said, you do? It's a reward. I said, for what? I said, what did you do that you should be rewarded? Now, in our society, we believe that if we've suffered, we are owed. Now, by whom, I'm not sure. But we believe that if we've suffered, the widows of 9/11 or the people who were in 9/11, the government paid them huge amounts of money for what? Because their husbands, wives, children died in that. Okay. Which has given them a platform to continue their wounds. Say what you will. What's the wisdom in that? I don't get the whole idea of celebrating suffering and expecting to be rewarded because you suffered. But this is where I assure you, if you have that, and you do, just assume you do, you will punish someone or something. A lot of people steal from their businesses, from where they work. And the reason they steal is because they feel that they are owed something, and they develop right here in right here that their boss is not taking care of them enough. Their wounded child comes out. Oh, boo-hoo. And now I'm suffering at work. And they pull out that Netflix in their head deliberately so that they can steal from their boss. It wouldn't matter where they worked or for whom they worked. They would instantly pull out the Netflix that says, I am going to be disappointed in this boss, this system, this place, so that I can steal from this person. They are addicted to stealing, to taking what's not theirs and rationalizing that that's not what they're doing. And that's this third world, which is your animal nature. Finally, this is the part of you that contributes to the worst of society. You know, when you look at what makes a good society, what makes it bad, this is the part of you that when there's a snowstorm coming, you're going to run to the grocery store and take everything for you first. This is the part of you that would turn into an animal at a moment's notice and not even recognize it. This is the part of you that is a predator, a killer. Make no mistake. This is the part of you that has what it takes to be a guard at a camp. Now, I'm telling you that when you think, I could never do that, this is the part of you where you find out you could. Where you find out you're angry enough if pushed, if betrayed, if cheated. If you think something is owed you, let's see what happens. If you don't get your inheritance, what are you capable of? If you have an addiction to your form of justice, and you're not able to let go of that, if you're not able to move on, what are you capable of? This is where you're addicted to what is owed you, and you're not able to move on. Right there. And I'm telling you that that particular addiction to yourself, what you think you're entitled to, by the way, I'm also talking to myself, okay? So though I put it in the you, I'm here with you. This is our make or break point. When it comes to a serious illness, and I look at someone who says, I'll do anything to heal, I look right here. I look at this addiction in this field of addiction, and if they're addicted to their own realm of justice, I don't care what healers they go to and what diet. I'm like, go eat cat food. You're going nowhere. I mean, that's what I know in my heart of hearts. Because at the end of the day, it's this addiction that is more toxic than anything they shove in their arm, up their nose, or down their throat. People, this is where the source of it really is. We'll get to healing. We'll get to the fundamentals of healing as the last lecture on this series, because I'm not going to leave you hanging. But I am going to leave you thinking about what it is you crave in this world. Where are you other than here? What are the myths you tell yourself? Right? And I'll leave you finally with this, one of the greatest prayers. When you find yourself feeling like you're leaving your body because there's something on the outside that's just too much for you to bear, from the slightest thing, become mindful of how easy it is for you to lose your center. Remember, think of me standing next to you like saying, come on, that's an illusion. You're attaching yourself to a spectacle. Let it pass. Let it pass. Let it pass. And take a deep breath and say, hover over me, God. This will pass. This too will pass. Hover over me, God. This too will pass. And hold your center. Hold your center. And wait a few minutes. And if you still want to attach to it, go ahead. No, seriously. If you still want to attach, then you go right ahead. But it will have dissipated by then. You'll find it difficult to find. And then you'll see what an illusion all of that is. So tell yourself, you got it? Hover over me, God. We're now going to speak about ourselves in terms of the ingredients of health and how they've changed, how they've wildly changed in ways that you never think about, but you're going to think about it now. Today, we casually talk about chakras, our energy system, having a medical intuitive reading, which is something I know about. We talk about past lives and their influence on our present day illness, which is wild. I did a reading on someone recently, and I was reminded of that because the person said, is this from a past life? And this man said that as casually as if he was asking me what a person would have asked a physician 40, 50 years ago. Is this medicine something I should still be taking? So that's a measure of how much we have changed, or to say it differently, it's a measure that we've entered a parallel reality. We no longer live in that world. We talk about being on a journey of transformation. We talk about being on a journey of the pursuit of consciousness. We don't even know what that is. If I stop and ask people, what are you pursuing exactly? The question baffles them. 90% of people are under a spell. They don't know what they're pursuing. They haven't a clue, but they're pursuing something. What? I'm on a path. What path are you on? Tell me what path you're on. I'm on a spiritual path. What does that mean? Tell me what that means. I haven't a clue what that means. Well, it's got to mean something. Well, if I actually examined people, they're completely baffled by that. Does it mean that you are suddenly conscious of values that you think other people never had? Is that what you think that means? That you're in search of peace and tranquility as if other people were never in search of peace and tranquility? That the great mystics had no idea about peace and tranquility? What does that mean? A spiritual path is about illumination and truth. It's not about tranquility. That's the name of health spas. But that's not a spiritual path. A spiritual path is not self-serving. It's about serving others. It's about becoming a vessel that is made ready to hear what God expects of you, not what you expect of God. But the way the human consciousness movement of today, or what I prefer, the human unconsciousness movement, has sculpted their off-planet God. It's what we expect of God. And that's the path people are on. We will get this idea in our head that all we have to do is think, and it happens. So entitled are we. A more preposterous idea I have never in my life come across. I'm reminded of the great book of Job, Where Were You When I Laid the Foundations of the Earth? Where did we get this? Nevertheless, we've gotten ideas in our head that definitely come from an understanding that we have an energy anatomy, which we do, that we have energy centers operating within us. I can't help but notice that it's very difficult for people to make the leap into acknowledging these centers as grace. It's very difficult for them to do that. It's very challenging because once you move into the field as grace, you're into a different altitude, and that altitude's the sacred. Once you're into the sacred, you're out of your mind, literally. And you're into a field that you no longer control, that requires prayer, that requires you take your shoes off in sacred ground, that requires you acknowledge your servitude to a source of power much greater than you. Further, it acknowledges that everyone else is sacred as well. So the narcissist in you undergoes what we must think of as transformation. So long as you speak in terms of energy, you make the rules. Your ego is still in charge. As soon as you get to the realm of the soul, you're not in charge anymore. Healing is an act of the soul. The mind cannot heal. We'll get to that in a minute. But at this point, what we need to acknowledge is we have sojourned into a realm where we don't know ourselves anymore. We are strangers in a strange land. We speak about our chakras. We speak about our energy system. We talk about that our attitudes have influence, but we're not sure how much or how. And we only address this when we're in crisis. If we're not in a crisis, we forget all this information. We act as if it's only applicable in a health crisis, but not when it comes to everything else in our lives, to the quality of our relationships, to the quality of how we interact with strangers on the street. We don't really think of the everyday functioning of our human energy system when we're in Whole Foods, when we're everywhere else. We don't think of ourselves We don't function within ourselves as if we actually get the fact that we've crossed the Rubicon and are existing in a parallel energetic reality. We only apply that when we hit a crisis zone and need a remedy. And then we run into the energetic remedy world. We go to holistic healers. We go to holistic treatment centers. We run to holistic authors. But we don't live there. We haven't a clue how we actually function in this world of our energetic psyche, in this parallel reality that we've actually entered, that has opened up. Are we somehow now more engaged with the collective psychic field around us all the time now? The answer is yes, we are. Are you more attuned, sensitized, more receptive? Do you transmit more of your shadow and more of your light to the world around you? Yes, you do. And here's the operative question for this series. Is that an influence on your health, your immune system, your psychic nature, your depressions, your anxieties, your creativity? How do you know where you stop and the collective begins? What about your archetypal influences, your mythological forces? Are they more animated now? Have you any idea who you are as an energetic being? And now let me add what I'm going to highlight in this particular CD. And that's that the language of transformation has been introduced into our, shall we say, social spiritual society. People use that word. We're going through a transformation. Things are changing. That's a big word to throw around. And if you look at the vocabulary we're now using, words like mystic, transformation, the soul, the human energy system, these are huge words to throw around if you don't know what you're talking about. These are loaded words. They are referring to a process that is actually taking place within you and around you, that is actually influencing every single corner of your life, including your health, including your relationships, including everything we're looking at around us. Now, we come from a world that has allowed us to live within the illusion that we are separate from the world we live in, that somehow we can go into our homes and, given who we are, how much money we make, what we do for a living, that we can separate ourselves by closing the door and not watching television. Now, whoever sponsored that illusion, let me say very clearly, is mistaken. So long as you are breathing the oxygen on this planet, you are a part of the oxygen on this planet. Let us just start there. You are mingling in its molecular collective life force. You are contributing to the psychic field. You are adding to its soul life force and therefore to what is being created on this planet. If you close the door and unplug your television, you are simply making a selfish choice to not see what your molecules are doing out there. So let's be very clear about that. Let's understand what's happening when you use the word transformation. What is happening now around you and thus within you? And does it affect your health? Have we entered in this parallel reality into a world where we need to now redefine what makes us healthy? What are we susceptible to in this parallel reality that we never were susceptible to before? I have people who say to me when I walk into a room and now the energy in the room affects me in a way that it never did before. To which I respond, and you affect the energy in that room in a way you never did before. Has that occurred to you? Has it occurred to you that it's you affecting the energy in the room and that you're getting a feedback from that? Has it occurred to you that you can affect the energy in the room, that you have what it takes to breathe grace into that room, to calm it, that you're not a victim that walks into a room and says, oh, I don't like the feeling here, and scampers away? The art of what you're learning is that you are one with everything. What is in one is in the whole. That the conscious being learns to use his or her consciousness as a constant source of choice and healing the whole. That this isn't about reporting in, oh my, I found another toxic environment, I need to scamper away because I've become so delicate and so sensitive. In the language of my Teresa of Avila, if this is what your inner life is doing to you, then you're doing something terribly wrong. You're making yourself weak and not strong. You don't understand the spiritual journey. You're making some very poor choices. Because the spiritual journey should make you strong and not fragile. Not so fragile that you can't even walk in a place and tolerate it. You should have your compass up and functioning by now. You should have your feet firmly on the ground. And you should be able to tell how to manage with your inside what's happening on the outside. And running away is not an option. So let's understand what transformation is all about. Let's go there. In many ways, it might strike people that transformation is a new word because they're unfamiliar with it, but it's not. It's in fact a very sophisticated, very well-charted, archetypal spiritual journey that has stages to it. Stages of unfoldment that are now taking place in you and around you. You simply can't stop it. It has been engaged. And in the world around us, as I describe these stages, you're going to see them as clearly unfolding around you. Recognizing that the pulsing of those stages are pulsating within you as well. What triggered an era of transformation is a topic for another time and another series, quite frankly. But suffice to say that evolution moves in a direction of pushing humanity toward an ever-awakening journey. So as we go back, we can see that with the coming of great spiritual teachers, humanity is given new templates of how to pursue itself, examining itself within the structure of, say, the Ten Commandments and the laws on the outside, to the teachings of Jesus and Buddha, the laws on the inside. And I'm just touching on teachers because this isn't about examining the history of great teachers and how they've influenced us and our biology, by the way. But where we go now is the template of holism. Instead of this era of separatism, divide and conquer, that has characterized us for the last 2,000 years, we're coming to this time of becoming whole. This is not going to be easy because it operates in direct opposition to everything you're used to. And this has distinctive stages through which we will pass through and more than once. So I'm going to describe these stages. And as I do, I'm going to talk about them both in the outside world and within you personally. And within you personally, you're going to feel them biologically. You're going to feel them psychically. You're going to feel them emotionally. Because these stages are stages you cooperate with and you fight. What needs to happen within the field of health is that these stages at some point need to be acknowledged as stress points in health. Now, we may be a long way from that, or not. I don't know. As Buddha says, things change in the blink of an eye. And it may be that at some point in the near future, spiritual journeys and their maps, which are very specific, can be used to understand what happens in a physical body, what happens in an illness, what happens in spiritual crises and sufferings that actually can result in chronic pain in the body, can actually result in chronic suffering in the spine, can actually result in a person deciding, I don't want to go there, and a cancer breaks out. That in fact, the transformation journey can be so arduous that a person can say no further. Because what is transformation? Let me begin by defining that. What are you transforming? What is that? I want you to picture an hourglass. Transformation is turning the hourglass upside down. So there's your image. But what's in the hourglass? Before the nuclear age, our entire world believed that matter, the physical world, and the laws of the physical world organized reality over the laws of energy, if they existed at all. What the bomb did, Oppenheimer, in splitting the atom, was he initiated the second Big Bang. That's how big that was. He turned the hourglass upside down. And in splitting the atom, all of us, all humanity, all life, everything went through the center of the hourglass, flipped it upside down, and all of a sudden, all the laws that would function in cause and effect, creation, magnetic attraction, action and reaction, all the energetic laws took dominion over the physical in a microsecond. The laws of energy took dominion over the laws of matter, just like that. Now let's follow that through. Just like that, the laws of energy took all of our watches off and said, up here, time doesn't exist for us. Up here, space has no meaning. You can't comprehend what I'm saying to you. Because what I'm telling you is a mystical truth. What I'm telling you is when Oppenheimer split the atom, we entered a parallel universe. And where we live now, while the world may look the same, it is not the same place. It never has been and never will be again. Ever since that moment, we have been running to catch up with trying to figure out where are we? Where are we? Nothing's the same here. It looks the same, but it's not. Everything's faster. Change is faster. It happens in an instant. Thoughts are now how we travel. We've created the internet to prove it. Now we're trying to figure out how to measure attitudes and their impact with illness. We're trying to find ways to measure what we cannot see. That's right, because the laws of energy can't be seen. That's right. Now I want you to go just a step further and recognize that everything that was built on the underside of that world with the laws of matter can no longer remain. Because they were built on a false system. Because energy comes before matter. These silly little things that are taught, like think what you want and you get it, are like giving plastic toys to babies in bassinets. Compared to what I am talking to you about. I am talking to you about the mystical laws, the laws that were revealed to the mystics, the laws that Jesus was talking to you about. These and other things can you do? These are the laws that have been the mystical governing laws of the universe. And they are as they are. These are the laws that reflect the nature of God. They are laws, and that is the nature of God. Law, period, done. There's no religion up there. There's nothing. It is law. It's a legal system. The highest laws you can access is when you decide that the laws you will operate are the laws of grace instead of the laws of your mind. Nothing could be a greater compliment than to be told you're out of your mind. What can the mind do? The mind's a useless instrument that you could program to tell you whatever you want. The soul is another force entirely. Transformation is the journey, the sojourn we are all on, in which those laws of energy are reconstructing the world of matter that we live in, transforming it from one reality to the other. This is the journey we're on. What's happening in the outside world is happening on the inside world. And it has stages. So I'm going to describe these stages in micro. You can recognize them in the macro, but you'll feel them in yourself. They operate in your biology, in your psyche, in your soul, in your world, in our world, and you can't stop it. The first stage of this bubbled up within our world in the 1960s, and that was the first stage's revolution. Now, think about yourself. When you know something's not right and you're in a form that's not right and it doesn't fit you and it doesn't suit you, the way your biology, your emotion, the way your body is going to feel is that you're going to start bubbling. You're going to start suffocating. You're going to start feeling smothered. You're going to start talking to yourself like this. I got to get out of here. I can't stand it anymore. You're going to start having panic attacks. Yes, you will. One of the symptomologies will be panic attacks, anxiety attacks. Your breathing will be altered. So let me give you the physiology that goes with this stage, because there is actual physiological counterparts to the stages I'm talking to you about. This is a breathing dynamic. Your oxygen will start to be affected at this first stage of revolution. If you could see a world map behind me, I now want you to imagine that I'm pointing to the world. And I'm saying the first stage of world crisis was indeed also an oxygen crisis as we entered into the environment and the beginning of the breakdown of the oxygenation environmental system. As we began the eruption of Mother Earth, a first system with her. This is also a revolution when your biology becomes susceptible to viruses and immune system. So the revolution, a collective revolution, can also produce epidemics. And of course, in the 60s, the seeds were planted for AIDS. So this becomes very fascinating. Now, why is that? Because the first stage of transformation is an awakening to what you cannot deal with anymore. You don't know why you can't deal with it. All you know is you cannot deal with it. All you know is the skin you're in, the pattern you have, is something you cannot bear anymore. Now, when something goes into a revolutionary rupture, in the middle of the beginning of that rupture, if I were to go up to you and you're screaming, "That's it. I can't take this anymore. I can't take this anymore." And I said to you, "Well, what do you want?" You would say to me, "I don't know, but I know what I don't want." Because during the revolt, during the initial explosion, when a volcano is going off, that's not when you interview the volcano. That's not when you go up to the volcano and say, "When are you going to stop this?" You got to let the volcano erupt. Like when I watch these reporters go up to kids at Occupy Wall Street, they're in the first stage. They're here. And they're representing the energy that I am now talking to you about. And when you go up to them and you say, "What do you want? Where are you going? What are you going to do? What's your long-term plan?" It's not incarnated yet. I'll tell you when it will, though, as I walk you through. And then they turn around and say, "They don't have a map. They don't have a plan. They don't have a program. They don't have a pension plan. I'm not going. They must be stupid. They must be just foaming at the mouth." Don't kid yourself. This is an archetypal journey. And their archetypal compass, the opposition, can feel in that archetypal way. This is serious. Archetypal compass to compass. This is the beginning. In the same way that the British felt it with the American rebels. These aren't vagabonds meeting under the Liberty Tree in Boston, 1769, 1770, trying to figure out how to carve the beginning of a great nation. No, they knew this smells like a revolution. This feels like trouble. One of the British wrote to the king, "These are not ordinary rebels. Don't dismiss these people. They mean it." Revolution, that first stage, you know when you mean it. And that's why you're terrified when this intuitive language begins to speak to you. In this new world, your new world of intuitive language, of intuitive biology that you've plugged into, this is how it speaks to you. It speaks to you in the language of transformation, and one of its words is revolt. Stage a revolution. If you don't revolt here, you will get sick. You will get sick. Because we've crossed a Rubicon. Your health is now tied deeply to what you believe in. Not just to what you believe in, but to truth. To how you feel. And not just about yourself, but to higher principles. It's a passageway. Underneath, it's all about you. Above that passageway, the stakes get higher. It becomes about life. So that first stage is when you revolt. So now after your revolution, look at the 60s. After the society revolted, and they said, you know what? No more boundaries around who I can sleep with, who I can love, whether I take drugs, and no more war, no more draft, no more this, no more that. I want you to picture everybody going like this, whew, that's over. Because they got everything they wanted, essentially. Civil rights, equal rights for women. Imagine that in this country that was the land of the free, not equal rights to the 1960s. So after everybody is exhausted and they got all their freedoms, this is when you say to the revolutionary, well, what do you want now? I know what you don't want. So let's go to the 1970s. Let's move you along. And the 1970s is quiet when the next stage is involution. After you revolt, what you will tell me, what anybody will tell you, is, I don't know, I've got to go think about it. You will withdraw. It's archetypal. And you will say, I'll get back to you. You will withdraw and get back to me. The 1970s, the society withdrew to get back to itself. Now that it could do whatever it wanted, what did it want to do? It had said in the 1960s, we could become anything. We could become spiritual. We could become conscious. It was the counterpart birth, like a burst of light. There was a whole faction screaming about love and possibility and light in the age of Aquarius. There was a whole faction that had arisen that said we could start organic. We could start this. But in the 70s, now that you have choice with your health, with your power, with who you are, if I said to you, what do you want? How healthy do you want to be? How empowered do you want to be? Let's talk about consciousness. Prior to the second Big Bang, the nuclear age, it would never occur to you, it would never occur to a doctor to say, your consciousness is a factor here. Your inner awareness is a major player in how healthy you're going to be. It's a major player here. So I got to ask you, how conscious do you want to be? How healthy do you want to be? You're sabotaging this. You stand the potential of sabotaging. How aware do you want to be of how often you sabotage something? Of how afraid you are to be able-bodied because someone may not come by to help you. That you may have to be more responsible for your finances if you heal. How able do you want to be? This is that second stage, the stage of involution, where you have to make choices about what you want. In the 1970s, our society backtracked. Instead of going deeper into its spiritual potential, it went deeper into its ego potential. And it began to give birth to the computer movement, to the high tech, to Silicon Valley, began to formulate a level of self. And what did we do? We did the same thing. The second stage is involution. It's a very interesting stage to watch people. When they come back, they often say things like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take up yoga. Or I'm going to, they'll present a healing program of transformation. But oftentimes their trinkets do the talking. They wear beads. They wear their stuff. But there's no follow through. They don't absorb the inner discipline. They don't become what they're talking about. That's number one. Or number two, they start the journey of transformation. And they'll say, I'm going to go into counseling. Great. I'm going to take up this. Great. I'm going to take up that. Great. And that is a boat across a river. Meant to get a person across, to get a person on the other side. But then comes stage number three, narcissism. This is that passageway that most people never make through. Narcissism, believe it or not, is essential to healing. And it was essential to us. And the 80s was our narcissistic decade, where we just gave the world the computer age. We were so full of ourselves. We narcissisticked all over the place. And within ourselves, that third stage is when, in therapy, someone starts talking to you and you identify your inner self. That's when someone starts talking to you like this. You have a right to. You are entitled to. What are you entitled to? Well, your boundaries, your wounds, you're entitled to your wounds. Who on earth would tell you, like, you are entitled to be wounded? You're entitled to the power of your wounds. And what power is that? You're entitled to boundaries. You're entitled to attention because of wounds. You're entitled to the front seat. You're entitled to get on the plane first. You're entitled. Your entitlements are endless. I remember what inspired Why People Don't Heal, that book I wrote years ago. When this woman said, I introduced her to two people I had just met myself. And then someone she knew came up and said, Mary, are you free June 8th? Because Helen Caldicott is coming here and we'd like someone to show her around. All she was asked was, are you free June 8th? She required a yes or a no. That's it. But instead, Mary said, June 8th? Did you say June 8th? Absolutely not. That is an incest survivor's workshop, and I would never let my girls down. Never, never, never. The hostility that poured out of her, the rage that poured out. The two men are sitting there like, boom. And you could feel that her fangs had come out. She was biting them as men in general. She was establishing a power zone. You treat me differently than anyone else at this table because I am a wounded woman. You could see the parameters being set all within 90 seconds. They couldn't wait to get away after that. Neither could I, but I was stuck. I was supposed to have lunch with her. Over lunch, I said to her, I need to ask you why you needed to let two strangers know within 1 minute of an introduction that you are, one, angry, two, wounded, three, the wound, incest, when all you were asked is if you were free June 8th. Why did your whole history come out? And she said, because I am an incest survivor. I said, did I ask you that? I said, I knew that. Why did they have to know that? I'm going to do this again. She got angry at me because I thought it was inappropriate to vomit this wound at any given opportunity. It was incomprehensible for her that someone would tell her that there was an inappropriate place for her to expose her history of being incested. Now that tells you the distance that we've come in these last years in terms of how we see being wounded. How public we are about this, and how it's become part of the narcissistic display. And how we have said, you have to talk about this. Healing requires a witness, but not a public display. And there is a difference. The narcissist, however, what happens when you're in this stage is that you discover a power of the self, and it's the shadow self that says, I've never had authority like this. I like this. I like this. I've never had any importance. I've never had any attention. And if I can get wound attention, what will I have if I let this wound go? What will I have? I won't have anything. What will I have? Who will I be if I'm not wounded? Who will I be? Who will I be if I don't have money? Who will I be if I don't have this? The narcissist forms itself around that ego, and it's all about me. And what we did during the 80s is we blended that woundedness with what we thought spirituality was, and we formed a hybrid spiritual journey. The all about me hybrid spiritual journey. Since when is spirituality all about you? It's all about God. It's all about truth, but it's not about you. It's about you pursuing the end of the small you. It's not about happiness. Happiness is fine, but it's not about happiness. And it's at that point, as a narcissistic culture, that all the things that were truly sacred were dismantled. And this is very important. We inverted our values, our health values. What we did is we took the archetypal journey of the soul, the spiritual journey, which is a journey of, why are you here? Why are you here? Is this a journey of your soul in your body, or your body in soul? What? Why are you here? You're living in a vessel that's designed to die. But we are death phobic. We can't even conceive of death. We don't talk about it. It's not even on the docket. We don't talk about what happens to our soul after we die. While we are comfortable with past lives because we make them up, they're a dime a dozen. And we're very comfortable talking about this illness must be from a past life. It's incomprehensible to people that there's no time in the energetic world. Therefore, there's no difference between what you call a past life or a future life. That the challenge you might have in your body could be coming from, in fact, what you would understand as a future life. Wrap yourself around that. In any case, it doesn't matter. The fact is, it's well out of your scope of understanding. You can't go there. But one thing's for sure, we don't go into the truth that we are aging. We've cut that out completely. And in the 80s, we made a science of it because we were into narcissism hot and heavy. This is when cosmetic surgery skyrocketed. This is when we decided we would conquer death. We would conquer aging while living in a society that says eat right and live forever, but don't age while you're doing it. Lie about your age. Learn to cut and paste Botox. Live forever so long as you can afford to live forever, by the way, and incidentally. Never talk about dying. In the 1980s, under narcissism, we got the idea that we could take on death itself. We got so big into our narcissistic britches that we actually thought we could outrun the life cycle itself. And that's when we really began to hate ourselves, to hate the bodies we were in, to hate the very cycle of life we were living. That's when discontentment with our own lives, the not enough syndrome,